Santa Monica. The United States military, Waterhouse has decided, is first and foremost an unfathomable network of typists and file clerks, secondarily a stupendous mechanism for moving stuff from one part of the world to another, and, last and least, a fighting organization. For the last couple of weeks, he has been owned by the second group. They put him on a luxury liner too swift to be caught by U-boats, though this is a moot point, since, as Waterhouse and a few other people know, Dönitz has declared defeat in the Battle of the Atlantic and pulled his U-boats off the map until he can build the new generation, which will run on rocket fuel and need never come to the surface. In this way, Waterhouse got to New York. From Penn Station, he took trains to the Midwest, where he spent a week with his family and reassured them for the 10,000th time that because of what he knew, he could never be sent into actual combat. Then it was trains again to Los Angeles, and now he waits for what sounds like it will be a killing series of airplane flights halfway round the world to Brisbane. He is one of about a million young men and women in uniform and on leave, wandering around Los Angeles looking for some entertainment. Now, they say that this city is the entertainment capital, and so entertainment shouldn't be hard to find. Indeed, you can hardly walk down a city block without bumping into half a dozen prostitutes and passing an equal number of night spots, movie theaters, and pool halls. Waterhouse samples all of these during his four-day layover, and is distressed to find that he is no longer entertained by any of them, not even the whores. Maybe this is why he is walking along the bluff, north of the Santa Monica Pier, looking for a way down to the beach, which is completely empty. The only thing in Los Angeles that isn't generating commissions and residuals for someone. The beach lures, but does not pander. The plants up here, standing watch over the Pacific, are like something from another planet. No, they do not even look like real plants from any conceivable planet. They are too geometric and perfect. They are schematic diagrams for plants, sketched out by some impossibly modern designer with a strong eye for geometry, but who has never been out of the woods and seen a real plant. They don't even grow out of any recognizable organic matrix. They are embedded in the sterile ochre dust that passes for soil in this part of the country. Waterhouse knows that this is just the beginning, that it will only get weirder from here on out. He heard enough from Bobby Shafto to know that the other side of the Pacific is going to be indescribably strange. The sun is preparing to go down, and the pier, down the beach to his left, is a light, a gaudy galaxy. The zoot suits of the carnival barkers stand out from a mile away like emergency flares. But Waterhouse is in no hurry to reach it. He can see ignorant armies of soldiers, sailors, marines milling around, distinguishable by the hues of their uniforms. The last time he was in California, before Pearl Harbor, he was no different from all of those guys on the pier, just a little smarter, with a knack for numbers and music. But now he understands the war in a way that they never will. He is still wearing the same uniform, but only as a disguise. He believes now that the war, as those guys understand it, is every bit as fictional as the war movies being turned out across town in Hollywood. They say that Patton and MacArthur are daring generals. The world watches in anticipation of their next intrepid sortie behind enemy lines. Waterhouse knows that Patton and MacArthur, more than anything else, are intelligent consumers of ultra-magic. They use it to figure out where the enemy has concentrated his forces, then loop around them and strike where he is weakest. That's all. They say that Montgomery is a steady hand, cagey and insightful. Waterhouse has no use for Monty. Monty's an idiot. Monty doesn't read his ultra. He ignores it, in fact, to the detriment of his men and of the war effort. They say that Yamamoto was killed by a lucky accident when some roving P-38s just happened across an anonymous flight of Nipponese planes and shot them down. Waterhouse knows that Yamamoto's death warrant was hammered out by an Electrical Till Corporation line printer in a Hawaiian crypt analysis factory, and that the admiral was the victim of a straightforward political assassination. Even his concept of geography has changed. When he was home, he sat down with his grandparents and they looked at the globe, spinning it around until all they saw was blue, tracing his route across the Pacific, from one lonely volcano to the next godforsaken atoll. Waterhouse knows that those little islands, before the war, had only one economic function, information processing. The dots and dashes traveling along the undersea cable are swallowed up by the earth currents after a few thousand miles, like ripples in heavy surf. The European powers colonized those islands at about the same time as the long cables were being laid, and constructed power stations where the dots and dashes coming down the line were picked up, amplified, and sent on to the next chain of islands. Some of those cables must plunge into the deep not far from this beach. Waterhouse is about to follow the dots and dashes over the western horizon, where the world ends. He finds a ramp that leads down to the beach and lets gravity draw him toward sea level, gazing to the south and west. The water is Pacific and colorless beneath a hazy sky. The horizon line is barely discernible. The fine, dry sand plumps under his feet in fat circular waves that crest around his ankles, so he has to stop and unlace his hard leather shoes. Sand has become trapped in the matrix of his black socks, and he pulls them off too and stuffs them in his pockets. He walks towards the water, carrying one shoe in each hand. He sees others who have tied their shoes together through belt loops, leaving their hands free. But the asymmetry of this offends him, so he carries his shoes as if preparing to invert himself and wade on his hands, with his head dangling into the water. The low sun shines flatly across the sand, grazing the chaos and creating a knife-sharp terminator at the crest of each dunelet. The curves flirt and osculate with one another in some pattern that is, Waterhouse guesses, deeply fascinating and significant, but too challenging for his tired mind to attack. Some areas have been stomped level by seagulls. The sand at the surf line has been washed flat. A small child's footprints wander across it, splaying like gardenia blossoms on thin shafts. The sand looks like a geometric plane until a sheet of ocean grazes it. Then small imperfections are betrayed by swirls in the water. Those swirls, in turn, carve the sand. The ocean is a Turing machine. The sand is its tape. The water reads the marks in the sand, and sometimes erases them, and sometimes carves new ones with tiny currents that are themselves a response to the marks. Plodding through the surf, Waterhouse strikes deep craters in the wet sand that are read by the ocean. Eventually, the ocean erases them, but in the process, its state has been changed. The pattern of its swirls has been altered. Waterhouse imagines that the disturbance might somehow propagate across the Pacific and into some super-secret Nipponese surveillance device made of bamboo tubes and chrysanthemum leaves. Nip listeners would know that Waterhouse had walked that way. In turn, the water swirling around Waterhouse's feet carries information about Nip propeller design and the deployment of their fleets, if only he had the wit to read it. The chaos of the waves, gravid with encrypted data, mocks him. The land war is over for Waterhouse. Now he is gone, gone to the sea. This is the first time he's taken a good look at it, the sea, that is, since he reached Los Angeles. It looks big to him. Before, when he was at Pearl, it was just a blank, a nothing. Now it looks like an active participant and a vector of information. Fighting a war out on that thing could turn you into some kind of a maniac, make you deranged. What must it be like to be the general? To live for years among volcanoes and alien trees, to forget about oaks and cornfields and snowstorms and football games, to fight the terrible Nipponese in the jungle, burning them out of caves, driving them off cliffs into the sea, to be an Oriental potentate, the supreme authority over millions of square miles, hundreds of millions of people. You're only tethered to the real world, a slender copper fiber rambling across the ocean floor, a faint bleating of dots and dashes in the night. What kind of man would this make you?